Hello, pigeons. You're my only friends in the world. Uncle Bat is going to feed you now. Just stay still. That's it. I brought you the buckets of meat you'd like so much. Ground chuck was on special. Hope you enjoy. Pigeons, why are you staring at me like that? Now, pigeons, I know that you're wild, but there's no need to get... What's that? Ah!
Okay, so I'm here with Courtney Humphreys, who is the author of Super Dove. Courtney, how are you doing?
I'm great.
First off, I wanted to ask you a rather obvious question before we get into the serious questions of science. You've actually dined on squab, and you allude to the fact that it's delicious, that it's dark meat, but as a carnivore and someone of a curio, I had to ask whether it was tasting like chicken or like duck or like turkey. I mean, you didn't go into specifics here. I'm wondering if the experience was possibly unsettling or you couldn't convince yourself completely that it was delicious because you also sympathize with these birds, but what about this?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit nervous about eating them just after, at the time, I had been, you know, looking at pigeons for a long time and was working on this book, and so I was very interested in them, so I was a little worried about, you know, eating a pigeon and how I'd feel about it, but it was really good. I mean, it's dark meat, they're small birds, so, you know, it's not, you're not getting huge pieces of meat, but, and it's kind of a dense meat, it's not fatty,
yeah,
you know, like duck is, but it's... But it's good, and I had it again actually recently in Chinatown in Boston where I live.
Yeah.
And it was crispy fried squab where they deep fry the whole bird, and they serve it to you and cut in pieces with the included the head.
Yeah.
So that was a little more nerving.
The head included. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little unnerving to me to have the head just lying there.
But you ate it anyway.
I did, but I have to admit I didn't feel as great about it as the first time I had it, which was at a very nice upscale restaurant where they just serve some pieces of the squab sitting on some rice. So
that's twice you've had pigeon. Have you had it any other time?
No, you know, it's actually, well, one thing, it's very expensive when you go to the nice restaurants. It can cost you a lot, but I wouldn't mind trying some more different varieties. I think if I was eating pigeon all the time and talking about how great they are, maybe I wouldn't.
You'd be branded.
Maybe I'd feel
in
a little strange
sense,
about
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, did you go to this Chinatown? I presume after the book was written.
Yeah.
And did just to kind of a, as a way of affirming that you wanted to kind of get the low version of the pigeon experience.
Yeah, you know, I knew that that's where there was when I had been looking for squab in Boston. I just saw that most of the menus where I found it was in Chinatown, and so I knew they have. That it's a tradition to eat squab there, and so I just wanted something different from what I had tried.
Well, let's talk about science.
Okay.
Near the end of the book, you actually make reference to Robert Dunn's pigeon paradox, which points out that urban animals, something as populous and as burgeoning as the pigeon, actually benefits other species in the sense that there is more of a conservationist impulse within humans. But I wanted to ask you, aside from these humans' communion with nature, because most of us now live in urban areas more than any other time at any point in human history, but what of other animals? I mean, how does the pigeon benefit them? Dunn didn't go into that. You didn't go into that. I looked actually at his paper to try to get an answer for this, but he was dealing mostly with humans. So what of this?
About how pigeons could benefit. Well, you know, I think the idea that he was getting at was that from an educational standpoint, you know, people are more interested in conservation when they connect with nature. And if you look at, like, say you're living in New York City, I mean, the wildlife that you see, you know, a lot of it is pigeons.
Yeah.
And so the idea, so, you know, traditionally, conservationists and the scientific community in general kind of neglects these types of animals. They're just not interested in things like pigeons, you know, and other urban things. But, you know, he was pointing out that there's an advantage to try to get people to care about the nature that's around them, even if it's, you know, these urban animals that are sometimes seen as pests. So I thought he had a good point that, you know, from the point of view of learning about an animal, I mean, I had the experience of writing this book, and I went out in Boston. And, you know, I actually am not a city person. You know, I really love nature, and sometimes I feel very trapped in the city. And so in this, when I wrote this book, I was going out to alleyways and watching pigeons, you know, build nests and have babies and raise them and stuff. And it really showed me that I could connect to nature in a way I really didn't appreciate. That there was, you know, that nature happens even in the city, and that there are animals that you can see, and then that it's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a gift to us to be able to watch these processes going on in the city, because a lot of animals, you know, don't care to go to the city. They don't like it, and it's not a good environment for them.
Yeah.
So the ones that can, I think we should, you know, appreciate them and encourage them, because I would rather have a city with wildlife in it than one with just us.
Yeah. I'll go back to the question of wildlife, but I want to touch upon this idea of pigeons being an absolutely indelible part of the city. I was a film student, and I should point out one of the reasons why your book sort of leaped out to me is because I made this short film about pigeons, where I went and I started asking people what they felt about pigeons. And then I would ask them what they felt about the city. Invariably, how they felt about pigeons reflected how they felt about the city.
Yeah.
Those who loved pigeons loved the city. Those who loathed pigeons and thought that they were flying rats and the like, the infamous Woody Allen quip, also took umbrage with the skyscrapers and gentrification, you name it.
Yeah.
But this is only empirical evidence. Did you uncover any scientific idea that has been generated about how people relate to pigeons as a way of sort of looking at the city through a prism, aside from this pigeon paradox that Dunn has here?
Well, you know, I think that's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that I found when I was doing this book was that, you know, a lot of scientists don't really think about pigeons. I mean, a lot of them are using them in studies like as laboratory animals, or in various ways when they're interested in something and they're sort of using pigeons to get at it. I really did not, there weren't a lot of scientists who just look at pigeons, like street pigeons, as something they want to study in itself. And so I think, personally, I think that's a great question. I don't know that anybody has looked at that kind of thing. You know, there's been, I think there's it's a pretty new area of research to look at people's attitudes towards nature and towards wildlife. And I would love someone to do a study like that.
Yeah.
Really,
because so
I think it's interesting too. You know, people, how we view. I just think it's interesting how some people, you know, are so horrified that pigeons are living on their buildings, and other people think it's great, and you know that we should encourage them. And so they really provoke contradictory attitudes, which is pretty interesting.
But back to this question of interspecies population and the pigeon paradox and how something benefits everything. We've talked of humans, but obviously they benefit crows in the food chain who come down and scoop up the babies and the like from their nests.
But you're asking like how, you know, do pigeons... So the pigeon paradox idea, it's sort of an indirect thing because it's saying that when people care about nature, they care about all nature more. And so people who... connect with animals in their environment, say, you know, kids growing up and they get to know pigeons that are around them, will then go on to care more about conservation, about nature in general, about wildlife. So I think the argument Dunn was making was a little more of an indirect benefit to conservation. I think, you know, I did, you know, wonder if pigeons, because they are an invasive species here, and so I wondered, you know, are they more harmful? You know, a lot of invasive species, you know, throw out other species.
Yeah.
They take over their territories. You know, and I did ask people that, and the answer I got was that they don't seem to be that harmful to other species because they really take up environments that other birds aren't going to be living in. Like, just because of their the way that they live on buildings instead of nesting in trees and that kind of thing, they really kind of take up areas that are that other species wouldn't want anyway.
Yeah. So they fill in that particular gap.
I mean, I think you could say there might be some competition for food and things like that, but in general, I found people don't see pigeons as being harmful.
But this question of food is interesting to me because there's only a certain amount of food, and yet the pigeons always seem to eat just about anything.
Yeah.
And then simultaneously, they're willing to, again, get into the leftovers or the dregs that perhaps other species are not willing to go ahead and sup
upon.
Right,
yeah, and that's why, you know, that's why they are so, you know, that's one of the reasons why they're so successful. They really can kind of feed off, you know, and I even watch... if you ever watch a bird feeder and you see all these little birds on the bird feeder and the pigeons can't get up there, but they can get all the stuff that falls down on the ground below, you know, they really can kind of pick up things that other animals just don't get to.
The dishwashers of Mother Nature, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Basically. Well, I wanted to ask you also about the quality of life between feral pigeons and urban pigeons, which are the two distinctions you make. Why do so many feel compelled to preserve urban pigeons and not think about feral pigeons? Does it really come back down to this pigeon paradox that they're not exposed or even aware of the fact that pigeons do live in the wild and they do actually hole up in caves and cove d'oats and the like?
Oh, you mean like the wild?
Yeah, the wild pigeons, the rock pigeons.
Yeah. And all that. There's the wild pigeons, and then the feral ones I was talking about are more like the urban. Because they have been domesticated, but they're now living wild. But yeah, there are populations of pigeons still living wild, you know, on their original homes, which is cliffsides, and yeah, I don't know. People aren't up in arms about the wild pigeons. I don't know. I mean, I think maybe part of it is just they don't really see them much. A lot of people don't know about them. They're in kind of remote areas. I mean, there are scientists who study the wild pigeons who have talked about, you know, how. I mean, basically, it's not that they're dying out or anything, but there's so much interbreeding because feral pigeons can live all over the place, and so there's a lot of interbreeding between them, and so some people have worried that the really wild ones are kind of going to disappear in a way. You know, they might still be living there, but there's a genetic heritage, you know, to being purely wild like that. So.
And the other thing that fascinated me, the question you raise about why don't we see baby pigeons, which you answer, it's because they are ensnared in their particular nests. Mm-hmm. They are essentially left to fend for themselves after about, I think, 2 months, I believe.
It's about a month, and then they start transitioning. They leave the nest, and then they usually hang out with their parents for a while before eventually.
And by that time, they're no more distinguishable than any other pigeon, which
is
fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I say though is that you can't it's hard to see a real baby pigeon because they are in their nest. The parents keep them under wraps, so unless you have really good access on your windowsill or something like that, it's hard to see inside a nest. But you can see young pigeons that are not that aren't fully developed yet. It's just that people, you know, and I've seen these birds sitting in nests, and to me, I know that they're babies, even though they're big, you know, they're big babies because they stay in the nest for a long time. But I do see people wandering around, and they don't notice them because they just look like a normal pigeon to them. But there are some subtle differences. You can see with the beaks, their beaks look bigger. They're kind of they're all black. They don't have that little white spot on top. They look kind of scruffy, and you know, so I do see young pigeons a lot now that I know where to look.
Yeah, now you become aware of them, now you see them.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of out of sight, out of mind,
exactly.
Reverse here. Well, also I wanted to ask, and this possibly may have something to do with the topic of individual variation, which I'll get into later, but one thing that is fascinating to me about pigeons is why some of them are so incredibly large and corpulent, while others remain these really skinny, svelte sort of pigeons.
Yeah.
Were you able to find any scientific study or any particular febrile observer who managed to figure out why some pigeons gorge more on food than others? Or?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I've noticed that too. In different places I go, there are some pigeons that are just very slender and some that look really really large, and I thought it was funny because I went in Boston, I feel like a lot of the pigeons are of the large variety, and when I went over to Europe, when I was in Switzerland doing some research for the book, they all just looked very thin.
Yeah.
And I felt like even, you know, the pigeons are in America are fat too or something, but
the ultimate telltale synanthropic sign here,
yeah,
perhaps of the cultures, I suppose.
Right, but you know, but I also think that there's a genetic thing where, and I actually asked somebody about this. And a scientist, and he was saying that it can also be, like, we have a lot of homing pigeons around here, and a lot of times homing pigeons get out, they get into the regular street populations, and so they're big birds, you know, they're actually bred to be more muscular and larger, so they can make these long flights that they do. So there's things like that where you might have a variation in the genetics of the breeds because of what's getting into the gene pool, and so that might be part of it too. I don't know, there's been a little bit of research on sizes and shapes of pigeons in different parts of the world, but I don't know if there's a particular answer. I think it's sort of a like local.
They're still trying to sort out all the subspecies of pigeons.
Yeah, and
the
I
like.
Don't know. I don't know if I could say that some pigeons overeat and others don't. I mean, I think a lot of it might have to do with just their build, you know, their body, their genetic,
but
body size.
This notion of nature versus nurture certainly factors into this particular question because, as you point out in the book, the question of whether pigeons, I mean, they're always flying home. It's not entirely certain whether it's some internal genetic mapping mechanism that actually causes them to do this. And yet, some pigeons manage to have a knack for returning home, perhaps more than others. And again, back to this question of individual variation, is there really any way one can draw an ultimate conclusion about pigeons because of so many subspecies that are untrackable, uncategorizable, and the like?
Yeah, that does make it hard. I mean, they're really complex birds in a way because they were domesticated, some of them have been wild for a long time, and so there's this, you know, real genetic variation in them. I mean, they're even just in, if you look at their coloring, I mean they're probably the most diverse bird around because, you know, if you look at the street pigeons here, you see brown ones, white ones, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of mixing going on with these birds, and I do think it you know, it's, and I think it's a really interesting scientific problem. I'm not a scientist, so, you know, but I think it'd be an interesting problem to see if you could take something as diverse as these pigeons and try to really trace, you know, some of these features or figure out why some have them and some don't. You know, it's a pretty interesting question.
Well, the other question I had, going back to cultural distinction, you write about an effort in Basel, Switzerland, in which they made an effort successfully to control the pigeon population. There was a researcher by the name of Daniel Hogg Wackernagel, which I hope I pronounced correctly. Mm-hmm. He led a public information campaign to encourage people to stop feeding pigeons. There were signs placed around the city, and Hogg believed that the reduction in pigeons came from a feeling of social unacceptability, this willingness on behalf of the people, that particular population, to conform.
Mm-hmm.
But the Swiss temperament, of course, is very different from the American temperament,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if in efforts to, I suppose, control the pigeon population so that it's not entirely out of control, so that the poor people who are cleaning the shit that they leave have less of a job to do, whether such a effort can actually occur in America because of this difference in temperament, whether the conformity that works so well in Basel may not necessarily work as well, say, in New York. I mean, there were efforts in the 1950s that you point out to say, hey, stop feeding the pigeons, but sure enough, here we are, 2008, there's still pigeons all over the place.
I mean, there's, you know, and there's always, this is always a question because, especially in New York, I mean, I do hear about, you know, efforts here and there, you know, to find people who feed pigeons or have, you know, some kind of... what was interesting about the Switzerland case was that, it was a public education campaign, which you don't think would work here because you do see, you know, you see signs everywhere, don't feed the pigeons, and who follows it? You know, the people who really want to feed pigeons will want to feed them no matter what. But what the Switzerland... what they did was they were also showing people... They were trying to make an argument that it's bad for pigeons to be feeding them, you know, and that, you know, an ecological argument that if you feed them, they'll just overpopulate, and that's not good for their health and good for the city. And so, and I think that's kind of, I don't know if New York has tried something like that, because I think, I mean, a lot of the people who are feeding pigeons really want to help them. And if you could, you know, kind of try to convince people that it's not helpful, that it's actually harming them, that might have a better effect than just trying to ban it or fine them or you know, to have signs saying don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think, you know, any pigeon control program has to accept the fact that a lot of people really like pigeons.
Yeah.
And so there has to be kind of a common goal that we want to have pigeons here, but we want a controllable sort of population that won't be a nuisance to people. I mean,
Switzerland doesn't have, though, something like the pigeon people who really want to make efforts to preserve pigeons, nor do they have such dumb posters as, say, the Subtalk posters you see in the subway, which you better throw away your trash because it's bad. I mean, mm-hmm. So I can imagine that any public information campaign that would be initiated hypothetically here mm-hmm. would probably fall in line with the Subtalk variety.
Right.
So I don't know if it's really something that is entirely compatible with this because of all these variegated strands of how humans parse information and how humans contend with something as magnificent as pigeons.
Yeah, and I don't know if New York would ever actually come up with a campaign that embraced the sort of diversity of or the complexity of people's views on pigeons, but I do think, like, you know, in theory, it'd be a better way to go about it.
Yeah. I also want to go back to this idea of how pigeons will use almost anything. You talk at length in this book, or write at length in this book, although the book did speak to me on many levels. you write about how pigeons often use any kind of material for their nests. They use dung, they use bones, of baby birds that have died. And yet urban pigeons, as we have discussed, also gravitate naturally to the more decrepit areas of the city, underneath bridges and in decrepit buildings and the like. Now, this is a fabulous example of a synanthropic species, but the verdict appears to be undecided on whether the pigeons prefer us because of this idea of domestication or because we perhaps represent the ultimate way for them to get food. I mean, is it truly maybe synanthropic is not the word, but more of a kind of symbiotic relationship? Because I don't think they're gravitating towards us because we are human. It's because we have this great scenario of resources for them to actually live off of and build things, and they're willing to go ahead and do it. So I'm wondering if the synanthropic idea here has been a little bit overstated by some of these scientists. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that they would, that it has to be, a synanthropic species chooses to live around people and their dwellings.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the definition. And so I think, it's sort of the whole package of human civilization. I don't think it has to be that there's something about humans that they love. You know, it has to be that there's some reason, there's something that we provide them that they're benefiting from and that they're choosing to live around. And so
rats too, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, we create all these habitats, and I don't think we see them as habitats for ourselves, but they can be habitats for other animals. And I think it's sort of a strategy more and more to try to take advantage of this, on the part of other species. So, I think you're right that it's because of the food, the shelter they get. I do think because pigeons were domesticated for so long, I feel like they do well with people. They are pretty interactive birds with people. I just feel like they have such a long history, thousands of years of living with people, that more than a wild bird, a totally wild bird that was never domesticated living in the city, I feel like they're just a little more interactive,
Yeah. They're more like wild cats and dogs to some degree. We can accept their form and their character in a way that that is just palatable enough, and certainly more palatable than, say, a rat, for example, but there are people who do love mice and rats as well. So I'm wondering how much, I guess, the notion of being a social synanthropic animal factors into this question of how they have become this evolutionary force in just about every urban area.
Yeah, well, I think, that's one of the advantages that I think pigeons have is that, since they're used to being around people, that's why they can survive so well in the city, whereas a lot of, like a wild bird, there's so much noise, people are scary, they're just so much, wild birds are so much more skittish, and so they have to kind of overcome that to be able to live in the city, whereas pigeons already were around people, and I think there's just, it gives them kind of an advantage.
Well, in relation to that observation, this occurs to me just now, the cooing sound that we now hear from pigeons. I'm wondering if there is any kind of evolutionary precept for how that has adapted. Did you find any early records of how this early cuckooing may have been described, say, 100, 200 years ago, and how it may have adapted to the present day, whether it's become more palatable for the human ear or what?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'd hesitate to say something that's so much a part of pigeons' way of being. You know, they're cooing. I mean, that's part of their, you know, mating rituals and things like that. So I don't know if anything like that would ever change in a couple hundred years. I mean, maybe. I mean, there are totally bred pigeons, like fancy pigeons, that actually make different noises because they've been bred to do that. But you know, just your average pigeon, I don't know if that would really change.
But there are birds who I've heard and who have been found that actually replicate urban sounds.
Oh, that's cell true. Phones. Yeah, the cell phone rings.
The cell phone rings, yeah. Car alarms. I mean, I once visited my sister and she said, you got to hear this particular bird. Mm-hmm. And the bird rattled off this complete list. It was a beautiful, it started off of its innate calling, and then all of a sudden it was alarming to hear it's mimicking all of the sounds that it gravitates around. Why does the pigeon not have that capacity?
Well, pigeons aren't making calls all the time. I mean, the cooing, you usually just hear that, you know, it's a mating thing. They're not out, you know, like some birds, they're just sitting on the branch calling out all the time. Pigeons don't really do that as much. They have kind of a different sort of mating ritual. I think of it more as a one-on-one kind of intimate thing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
So that might be why.
It doesn't go out and strut its stuff. Yeah. There's also the one, I can't remember which nature program I saw it on, but there was this creepy video of this bird actually reproducing the shudder of a camera going off.
I saw that too.
Yeah,
actually.
It's on YouTube. You can feel it. I want to talk about Richard Johnston, who you actually tracked down. He's the author of Feral Pigeons, and he's one of the few people who has actually devoted a good portion of his life to studying pigeons, and he came into studying it quite late in life, almost by accident. You had alluded earlier to this problem of scientists not really wanting to examine this particular topic. You tracked down Louis Lefebvre, who pointed out to you that scientists don't study pigeons because pigeons are good innovation for the wrong reason, because of artificial selection. Is it this artificial selection idea that causes scientists to not want to study them? The problem of the God idea or the intelligent design idea being applied to artificial selection? Are we just not in a scientific environment right now where something as omnipresent as pigeons that involves our own relationship to them, our own behavior causing their particular population to wane and wax, this very important issue is just not tenable in our current scientific environment? Did Lefebvre tell you anything else besides this, or what was it do?
I think that's true. I think that you know, there are certain you know, prejudices in science, and I think that definitely there's a tendency to want to study what's considered typical nature, wild animals, and so the pigeon doesn't quite fall into that because, you know, it might be living wild, but it's had this history of domestication. And I definitely found, you know, a lot of people I talked to, they would have a lot of things to say about pigeons, but they wouldn't necessarily study them. And a lot of it, you know, you have to, you know, there are these sort of philosophical divisions, you know, between what's natural and what's artificial and our role in things. And I think there's sort of an anxiety about our role in nature, and you don't want to actually study anything that we've touched or something. But I also think, you know, and it plays out in ways like, you know, a lot of scientists might be interested in this if they could get grants to do it, you know, and so there's a whole structure about how science is funded, you know, about how these projects get started, that it makes it a little hard to make a case about why you should be studying pigeons. So yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons why that happens, but you know, I think that there is a trend now towards urban ecology, urban wildlife studies. So it might change a little bit, but definitely the idea that pigeons are kind of complicated because of domestication makes them a little unattractive for people. And the other thing about science is that it's so important for scientists to simplify. And I always forget that because I'm not a scientist either. And so I get very interested in things that are very complex, you know. But, you know, to be able to make some kind of observation that can stand up to scientific scrutiny. You know, they have to control variables, and they have to make things simple and ask very pointed questions that they can answer easily. And with things that are really complicated, like pigeons, it makes it hard to, like we were talking about with the genetics. I mean, it'd be great to kind of trace some of this genetics, but it, because it's so, you know, it's such a mishmash, it makes it hard to do the science.
Did Johnston tell you a lot of these hurdles? Did he convey this to you? I mean, you allude to some of your conversations with him in the book of this particular problem, but I'm wondering if, as he's about to retire, he's getting out of this thing that he's been occupying himself with for like the last, you know, two decades of his life, he manages to convince a university press to publish feral pigeons, and yet even today it's almost as if he's forgotten. I mean, what caused him, do you think, to study pigeons more so than, I suppose, another scientist? It seems to me that the only way that any scientist stumbles onto the idea of pigeons is largely by accident.
Yeah, I think that he saw it as just kind of an interesting, you know, he doesn't go on and on. You know, I had to kind of prod him with some of these questions, but I think that my sense of it was that he saw them as an interesting problem, and he wasn't really bothered by the fact that, you know, that they had been domesticated and things like that. And I think he also had a very practical reason. You know, he said that there's a lot of pigeons everywhere, and he could study them pretty easily. And, you know, when you're a scientist, not having to get a grant to go out to South America to study your bird is actually kind of an advantage. So he was pointing out some advantages that the pigeons have. First of all, there's lots of them, and he does studies on, you know, he was doing studies on variation in shape and size and things like that. And for that kind of thing, you have to have a big sample.
Yeah.
So he could go out and get a lot of pigeons and compare them and get data. And so to him, that was a power in itself. And he wasn't really bothered by the fact that, you know, they were unnatural or anything like that, which I thought was pretty cool. And that's kind of why his book was so important for me, because first of all, it had so much information, but also just his attitude about this is a really interesting thing to study. It's not worthless because of the domestication, because of the artificial selection, and because they live around people. It actually kind of makes it more interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I also wanted to ask you about the role of pigeons during World War II and before as being used to send messages. General Mills, of course, gave B.F. Skinner some money as a public service to find out more about pigeons. This was then transformed into a federal grant, which encouraged Skinner to likewise look for a natural organic homing device, which he could then use to have the pigeons control missiles. Now, he was not able to get the precise information from the government as to the extent of the missile system that they had, but this brings to mind the conclusion of the experiment, where it was revealed that the pigeon was sitting there pecking away at food. And I'm wondering that even if he had the information, let's say that he did, it's very possible that it still would have come down to food in the end. And I'm wondering if Skinner was overstating the role of pigeons, the capacity of pigeons a bit, because at the end of the day, they are wandering around looking for food and going home largely because this is their innate process, and that's really, really their role. Now, the people who use them to send messages were able to understand this, and as a result, pigeons were effective for them, but ultimately they have this singular purpose. So what of Skinner's folly here? I mean, it did end up allowing him to pursue other things that were of greater consequence, but I'm wondering if this was less of a false start and more of a kind of false set of assumptions here.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by false set of assumptions.
I'm saying that because the pigeons were looking for food and that this was their primary purpose, whether Skinner fully accounted for this, much as the cognitive people at Tufts who are looking to pigeons for you know, the ability to, yes, the pigeons can read, yes, the pigeons can actually keep track of numbers and all of these extraordinary claims, whether this is really fully taking into account the fundamental idea that pigeons really are after food. They're foragers first and foremost.
Well, I think, I don't think Skinner really, I don't think it was really relevant to his thinking what they were looking for. I think he was more interested in behavior and how to make a pigeon do something. And the way to do it was through food.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the people who are doing these sorts of behavioral studies, the food was just kind of it's a convenient way to get a pigeon to do something you want, you know, or to control its behavior. But they didn't really think too much about the natural role of pigeons or their natural tendencies and why they were getting the food and what, you know. It was more about trying to make behavior predictable. And he did do that. You know, he made his, these pigeon pilots who were, who would be guiding these missiles and were very good at being very consistent and finding their targets and pecking them. And so to him, I don't think he really worried about why they were doing it. You know, as long as they were doing it.
But
you know?
Let's talk also about Robert Cook's experiments at Tufts, which are these cognitive experiments. I mean, they remind me very much of Harry Harlow's experiment with the rhesus monkeys, where I'm not certain how plausible it is, given that they are looking first and foremost for food, given that it was decided that, or it was found that these pigeons were able to anticipate the moves in these particular Skinner boxes, because ultimately they were looking after food. I mean, is Cook overestimating the capacity of pigeons, or are they not looking squarely at to what pigeons are really capable, or really that it's their relationship to the environment and the relationship to trying to find food here?
Well, I think, I mean, like I said, I think the food is a way. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that they're using a natural behavior of the pigeons as kind of a convenient way to do experiments, you know. I think, you know, I mean, it's a question. There's definitely a question of what's going on in the pigeon's head when it's doing these things. All they know is that, you know, if you put these three colored boxes on the screen, the pigeon can pick the right one, you know. It's doing that. Its motivation is to get food. But I don't know if that discounts whether it can actually do that, because its performance shows that it can recognize those things. You know, I mean, I guess you say, or I guess they see the food as the motivation, you know,
yeah.
The same way that you know, we go to work every day because we're going to get money in the end, you know. And I mean, there's other motivations other than
sure.
that. But
and we have a lot going on more than the pigeons.
Yes, yeah. But you know, I just think that that they see the food is sort of the paycheck at the end. But the real question they have in their heads is what are pigeons capable of, and how does the mind work? And the food reward is sort of the convenient way to find that out.
I guess what I'm asking is, short of a functional MRI that could somehow be applied to a pigeon, I'm wondering if such experimental data, such observational data, is really a way for us to understand, I guess, the cognitive potential of the pigeon, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, it's definitely to be continued. It's to be seen whether this kind of animal cognitive science, where it's going to go and what it can let us understand, because it's trying to get inside the black box of any animal's mind, and we don't really know what's happening. All we know is you can do an experiment, you get a result. And I think, you know, the way, when I asked cognitive scientists about this, like, how do you even know what the pigeon's doing? You know,
yeah.
How do you really know what's happening? I mean, they totally understand that the kind of science they're doing is pretty new, and they don't really know. But it's more like they're trying to develop models. So, like, if they can develop a model of how the mind works, and then they can start doing experiments and seeing if the experiments support those models, then they have a good guess as to what's happening. So they're not, I think they understand that it's pretty difficult to know what animals think and if they think like we do or if they don't, and that there's all these pitfalls because we have all these assumptions about how our mind works.
Yeah.
And you might be constructing a study that or an experiment that's totally that's not even taking into account the way the animal's mind works because of our own assumptions about how our mind works.
Yeah.
So there's all these pitfalls, but I think they just see it as it's worth doing, it's worth trying, and that they're really just trying to, the way they approach it is to try to make a general model and see if the data will fit that model.
So really what we're seeing here is the early stages of pigeon science still. They're just, yeah. It's essentially a nothing ventured, nothing gained sort of thing with these.
You know, it's working towards, trying to understand the mind given the tools that we have, you know, which even an fMRI isn't going to tell you it's going to show that something's active and something's not, but it's not going to really, it's hard to understand another species, their minds, so, you know.
Going back to my last question, about Charles Walcott and his idea of, it could be just about anything that determines how pigeons are able to map the world around us. It could be their innate sense, it could be their ability to have a sense of smell. The fact that there's such inconsistency in terms of pigeons, because it all comes down to individual variation near the end. Are we any closer now than we were, say, a decade or even a century ago to understanding how pigeons operate? Or do they evolve so fast, do they change and adapt so fast that it's almost a case of, well, we're going to have to really amp up our science in order to really understand precisely how their character is? I mean, how we carry on this synanthropic relationship?
He was looking at pigeon homing, and I think there's been so much research on how pigeons home, and I think it's I think his point was that it seems contradictory because all these different people are finding all these different mechanisms, and they're arguing over whether this mechanism is working or this. And I guess, you know, his answer was maybe they all work, but that different pigeons draw on different abilities or different tools. And you know, and I so I think that you know, as far as homing, I think that. It's more. It's not that this research isn't moving somewhere, and that we're not finding out, you know, how pigeons home. It's just that we have to remember that there's not always one right answer, you know. And so, to me, that was the lesson of my conversation with him, is just that, you know, that the things are complex, and that you know, you can't expect to have the one answer for how these, you know, why pigeons are the way they are, you know, or why they live in certain places and not others, but that it's that you might end up with a lot of complex factors working together.
Got it. Well, Courtney, thanks very much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks.
All right.
It was fun.
Thanks.